All right, so what do you think of time's up?
I'm glad we're it's about over.
You can admit it. You're not. Okay, that's good. All right, so should we just do like a mock on Tennyson? We could do all of them in the morning. Last time I took this course, we did. The first time I took a course with Tennyson in it in graduate school, I read the head note to In Memoriam, and what it said is, the first time you read In Memoriam, you should read it in a single sitting. And it is really long. In fact, the Norton Critical Editions has a single volume of In Memoriam. But I thought, okay, I will. That was a mistake. And then my professor said, you did what? She thought it was a mistake too. Part of what that's about is the extent to which Tennyson is an acquired taste. And I think he's particularly acquired. It's a taste that you particularly need a lot of acquiring these days. I think some of the other Victorian poets we do will seem equally not what you tend to expect from poetry. It's not that Tennyson is like doesn't give you a lot of what you expect from poetry, but there's also a lot which is not really familiar as what poems do now or what poems did before Tennyson. And there's a whole lot of meditation in Tennyson, but the meditation is more, you could say, through images than through discursive thought. So you get lots of meditation in Wordsworth, for example, but the meditation, when he gets to be meditative, it's discursive. He's telling you just what he's thinking about. And there's a way in which what's happening in Tennyson is that those meditations take the form of attentiveness to strangeness. And if you were to spend a lot of time saying, this is so strange, the poems might be easier. But they also would be, you might say, demarcating where the strange was. That here's this strange experience, which is what he does in The Princess, as I mentioned before. You have a narrator in The Princess who goes into these strange, fugue-like, dream-like states, and that's part of the plot, but it's a particular thing that happens to him. And when it happens, you know, there are issues in the narrative. But often it's just not part of the plot, it just is, so that all experience is an arch through which you look for a remoter world, you look for a remoter experience, which will itself become that arch of what we were looking at in Ulysses. So there are a few things that I want to point us to today, but partly I think the thing about Tennyson is he is worth the effort, which can be, I'd say for any really good poetry, any great poetry, you have to feel is worth the effort. And that's what makes it great, is that it's gonna be something that you haven't seen before. That isn't just, a good version of what I know. Even a really good version of what I know. So any poetry that is giving you something you don't know, you have to make an effort to see what's going on. And I think any poet that matters to you, any poet that you love, you've made that effort at some point in your life. And you've overcome a kind of resistance. And usually, though, poets who are worth the effort, you can see from the start that they're worth the effort. Or you can see early on that they're worth the effort. And it may be that Tennyson is the poet who you need the most cheerleading from a professor to beg you to see that he's worth the effort, and that if you actually make the effort, his strangeness is as radical in its in what it does as any poet in English. He's really, really at his greatest. He's really, really takes a lot to see what's so great about it. So part of what we're doing in this class, but only a part of it because we have so much else to do, is me urging you to see that he's worth the effort, and also to see kind of what that effort is about. So one thing that Hallam said, so Tennyson published his first book of poetry when he was like 21, and Hallam, his friend, reviewed it and gave it a good review where everyone else gave it terrible reviews. And for a long time, Tennyson just didn't publish. Plus, that reviewer died. Hallam died, so that's not what Tennyson was thinking. Oh no, my best reviewer, what he was thinking is the only person I ever loved and ever will love. But it also meant that someone who he thought got what he was doing, someone who did get what he was doing, Hallam in his review referred to Tennyson's fairy beauties. And that is, I think, a good two-word phrase for a whole lot of what you get in Tennyson. So someone who really got what Tennyson was doing, someone who Tennyson cared about more than anyone else to get what he was doing, he died. And so Tennyson goes into mourning over that. So I think what I want to do is go from today is to go from something fairly microscopic to something broader. So if you look at the lotus eaters, and to talk about this as microscopic in a way is to remind you that the poem, that this long-ish poem is based on really four lines in the Odyssey. It's just, we went to the land of the lotus eaters and everyone wanted to eat lotuses, but I said we have to go, so we left. That's basically what it says in the Odyssey. And the land of the lotus eaters are characterized as a place in the Odyssey. This is a half line, as a place where people weren't troubled by stuff because they had these lotus gummies that made them feel great. So Tennyson picks up on that, and what most of the poem is, and we won't do this, but it's worth noticing, what most of the poem is a choric song. And what that means is that once you're eating the lotuses, what do? You sing. And you just sing and sing and sing. So would someone read the first stanza? Yes, Leon.
Okay.
Go for it.
Courage, he said, and pointed toward the land. This mountain wave will roll us shoreward soon. In the afternoon they came unto our land, in which it seemed all this afternoon. All round the coast the languid air did swoon, breathing like one that has a weary dream. Full face above the valley stood the moon, and like a downward smoke, the slender stream along the cliff to fall and pause and fall did see.
Great, thank you. So does anyone know the form of that stanza? This is something we will have a lot of occasions to talk about in this class, poetic form. And not a lot of these forms are not standard. This is a standard form, but it may not be one you know. It may be one you don't know. So does anyone know? Okay, so check out the rhyme scheme. Can someone say what the rhyme scheme is?
A-B-A-B-B-C-B-C-C.
Yes, good. A-B-A-B-B-C-B-C-C. Nine lines, and there's an interlocking rhyme scheme between So this is actually the best way to put it, is to say there's an interlocking line scheme between the first five lines and the second five lines. So even though it's nine lines long, what you could say is the first five lines form a kind of unit. The rhyme scheme is A, B, A, B, B. The second five lines also form a kind of unit, the rhyme scheme being B, C, B, C, C. So you can see the first five lines have the rhyme scheme 1, 2, 1, 2, 2. And the second also are 1, 2, 1, 2, 2. So does everyone see that? Yeah.
Do you have an extra copy?
Oh, sorry. I do. But what's it worth to you? Okay, so do people see that? And what tells you if you're just listening to this? Well, let's just look at the last line of each stanza and tell me if you hear, I'm just gonna just listen to it and tell me if you hear what's going on. Along the cliff to fall and pause and fall did seem. Stanza two. Up clomb the shadowy pine above the woven copse. Stanza three. The mild-eyed melancholy lotus eaters came. Just feel how that line is like the lotus eater. The mild-eyed melancholy lotus eaters came. Fourth stanza. And music in his ears, his beating heart did make. Fifth stanza. Is far beyond the wave, we will no longer roam. So if you can hear the rhythm of that, do you feel like you're hearing that the rhythm is the same in all those five lines? Notice how they're different from courage, he said, and pointed toward the land, or a land of streams, some like a downward smoke, or the charmed sunset lingered low adown, or branches they bore of that enchanted stem, or they sat them down upon the yellow sand, which, by the way, is an allusion to the tempest, just to mention. So do you hear, even if you're not sure why, that the rhythm is different? So in all eight lines, in all the first eight lines of each stanza, the rhythm is different from the ninth line. So do you get a sense of what makes for that difference? You can always use your fingers. Louder, louder, louder.
There's 12 syllables in the last line?
Yeah, each last line has 12 syllables. And one way you can hear that is if you look at, let's say the last line of the second stanza, up clomb the shadowy pine above the copse. That would sound like all the other lines. If I leave out woven, leave out two syllables. Or the melancholy lotus eaters came. You can hear that that's working, right? And music in his ears his heart did make. So I'm just leaving out trochees. That is, I'm leaving out a two-syllable word or two syllables, and then it sounds like all the other lines. Is far beyond the wave we will not roam. Instead of is far beyond the wave we will no longer roam. So hear that again. It's worth training your ear to this. Along the cliff to fall and pause and fall did seem. If you wanted to make that 10 syllables, you could leave out the and pause, right? Along the cliff to fall and fall did seem. Then it would be 10 syllables. Up clomb the shadowy pine above the copse. The melancholy lotus eaters came. And music in his ears his heart did make. Is far beyond the wave you will not run. So if you're hearing how that turns into 10 syllables by, do people know what the word bombastic means? Anyone?
As a literary term or just like?
No, just as a term. If someone is bombastic, what are they doing?
They just won't stop talking.
They won't stop talking, and they're just overdoing their rhetoric. Anyone know what bombast now is a technical term is? Not a literary term, and not even a linguistic term. So bombast is filling for clothing. Like if you get shoulder pads in Shakespeare's time, that would be called bombast. If you're wearing some clothes and they don't fit you right, a tailor might put some cotton or some other stuff in it to smooth it out. That's called bombast. And so it became as a metaphor when people added syllables to lines to make them follow a meter. So bombastic poetry is poetry where you can tell that there's stuff filled in to make the meter work. As Pope, one of his joke lines is, and feeble expletives their aid do join, and 10 low words on creep in one dull line. So feeble expletives their aid do join. If you've ever tried to write rhyming poetry, you'll know that you sometimes add a do when in regular English you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't say, oh yes, and feeble expletives their aid do join. You would say, and feeble expletives join their aid, or their aid join. But the do is there in order to make the line work. Or sometimes you have to put in a do so that you can say, you can rhyme, and she's the one he does love. Because if you said she's the one he loves, it wouldn't rhyme with the word dub in the previous line. But if you had a does, then loves can be love and you get a good rhyme, but that's bombastic. So it's filler is what bombast means. It's filler in poetic lines. And used a lot in Renaissance drama, so when people call Shakespeare bombastic, they said, yeah, he just puts in all these extra syllables so it can sound like... this is the people who didn't like Shakespeare in his day. They were jealous of him, and they called him bombastic. But it was a standard thing to do. So, in a sense, the thing to see here in Tennyson is that it's the opposite of bombastic. That when he adds syllables in these ninth lines, they are two syllables like ant pause. So what's happening in the line at that moment? Along the cliff to fall, and pause, and fall did sing. What would be a good verb for what the line is kind of doing at that moment as it lengthens out?
It's like it's pausing or slowing down.
Yeah, it's like a pause. It's like the whole Lotus Eaters feel, the whole Lotus Eaters experience. You can feel that there's a kind of pausing in the line, a slowing down of the line, that and pause is, you're not calculating this and working it out, but if you were an actor reciting this, that's probably where you would linger, is along the cliff to fall, and pause, and fall did sink. And you can even hear it in the assonance of fall and pause. That is fall, same vowel, but pause is a longer word. Same stress, right? It's along the cliff to fall and pause and fall. It seemed all iambic. Da 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 da. But the length of the syllables is different. So along the cliff to fall and pause. I'm exaggerating, but it's the natural way to exaggerate. Along the cliff to fall and pause and fall, it seems. And Tennyson actually wrote what is called quantitative poetry just to show it could be done. That is poetry whose meter is not in stresses, but in how long it takes to say a syllable. It's something we don't pay much attention to in English and never have, except in songs, where sometimes, you know, I loathe Bob Dylan, so But what I can say is, you know, if you say, and it's a hug, and it's a hug, because I love them, I'm willing to torment you with my singing voice. It's a hard ring that I'm going to fall. Do you know Dylan?
A little.
Do you like him? You know the right answer, right?
I loathe him.
Good, yes. I loathe. So what I just do with loathe there? I made it a really long syllable. I loathe Bob. So both stress, but loathe is long and Bob is short. So not stressed, unstressed, but long and short. Tennyson will do effects, will create effects that have to do with length as well as with stress. So look at the third stanza. The mild-eyed melancholy lotus eaters came. You can see that mild-eyed is what's added to the line to make it 12 syllables, right? The rest of it is the melancholy lotus eaters came. That would be fine. But then he adds mild-eyed. And what does that do sound wise? Mild-eyed. What do you call that? Do you know? Did they rhyme mild and eyed? Not quite. Yeah, why not?
Because they do not end with like the same syllable and consonant combination. For mild, you got a deep sound.
Well, you do an eyed, but you don't have the L in eyed.
Yeah.
So mild, it's not mild isled, which would be ridiculous, but you could say the island of the lotus eaters was mild isled. But mild eyed is called assonance. So assonance, so you all know what alliteration is, right? Murmuring of innumerable bees, do you know what that's from? Tennyson, we read it. And it's actually a tip that has to Virgil. Does anyone know Latin? Does anyone take Latin? So do you know the line in Virgil he's thinking of? It's fine if you don't. It's
not really good.
It's magna cum murmure montes. That is, that there's a lot of murmuring in the mountain, and Virgil's line is famous because of the alliteration, magna cum murmure montes. Assonance is when you have the same vowel sound, not the same consonant sound. So mild-eyed is assonant. And then melancholy, so mild, melancholy, that's alliteration. So notice how they're overlapping. The mild-eyed, melancholy, lotus, picking up the L from mild and melancholy, came, picking up the M from mild and melancholy. Okay, so is this English teacher over-reading, or can you actually get yourself to hear it as I say it? Yeah, so why Rena nods. We all nod the way she just did. It's there. And it's not that Tennyson is thinking, ha, I need another M word. It's that his ear is so good that he is just hearing how good that is. And mild-eyed, that would be the extra two syllables, making it also mild. Or, and music in his ears, his beating heart did make. Beating is obviously the word you don't need to make it pentameter. And it's not a word like pause. It doesn't slow things down, or does it? So why would beating be a good word to add to that line? And music in his ears, his beating heart did make. Just paraphrase that line first. Someone paraphrase it.
So his beating heart is making music in his ears.
Yeah, he's hearing his heartbeat. And it's turning into music in his ears. Okay, and Arena, what were you going to say?
Is it the stress on beating and how it fits with the rest of the line?
Okay, so it certainly does.
Like it makes a beat.
Okay, nice. So beating makes a beat. Good. And if you talk about a beating heart, generally it means, look, that person's alive. Their heart is beating. But here, of course, he's alive. That's not an issue. So somehow, with the word beating, maybe what you could say is, you become aware of how he is aware of the beating of his own heart. So even though it feels like it's propulsive, there was a theory at the time, which is not true, but lots of people believed it in the 19th century, and all through the 20th century, actually, that meter had to do with heartbeat, that your heart went ba-bump, 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 and meter was in the same rhythm as a heartbeat, which is why people like poetry so much. The problem being that two-syllable meters belong to some languages and not to others. Greek and Roman poetry has a three-syllable beat. There are other kinds of poetry that have up to four-syllable beats. So it doesn't really work that way. But still, you can maybe hear it here, that music in his ears, his beating heart did make, that at that moment, he's paying attention to the beating of his own heart. Which means he's not paying attention to getting somewhere. He's looking at his Fitbit as he runs, which slows him down. What, you think that's a bad metaphor? Yeah, it is. But becoming aware of his own beating heart means that he becomes inner focused. He hears the beating of his heart, and it's beating, gotta get somewhere, boom, 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 boom. It's turning into music. So even a word like beating is a word that he is now slowing down on, which is something that the lotus does. That, yeah, your heart is beating, but you're slowing down on everything. So Tennyson no longer needs a word like pause in the last line of the first stanza, or mild-eyed. Now it can be beating. But we've so slowed that even that becomes slow. Okay, so I'm just going to read, just because we have to get on, these five stanzas. But what I will tell you is the form is something called a Spenserian stanza. And it was invented by Edmund Spenser for his great poem, The Faery Queen. Which is, if you get the Penguin edition, it's 1,000 pages long, and you will find it too short once you finish it. Spenser died before he finished the poem, so it's only 1,000 pages long. He had planned it to be 4,000 pages long, but then he died. But it's totally great, and people, including Tennyson, became obsessed with it. Anyone know the great Shelley poem written in Spenserian stanzas? Adonais is, it's not the only one, but it's the great, The Revolt of Islam is also in Spenserian stanzas. Wordsworth did a little bit of writing in Spenserian stanzas. Keats did some writing in Spenserian stanzas. But the way a Spenserian stanza works is you have that interlocking of the first five and the last five lines. But there's a kind of conclusiveness in the last line because it has an extra foot. So Spenserian stanzas are eight lines of iambic pentameter followed by a ninth line in iambic hexameter. A 12-syllable line in English poetry, do people know what it's sometimes called? It's called an Alexandrine. So this is, again, something to know. It's French poetry is written in 12-syllable lines in general. Formal rhymed French poetry tends to be classical French poetry in 12-syllable lines. It's called an Alexandrine because there's a great medieval French poem about Alexander the Great, and it was written in these 12-syllable lines. So in French, it came to be called the form, or the vers d'Alexandre, the form of this poem. And then that got picked up in English, and since I quoted Pope for you already, I'll tell you another joke Pope tells, which is, he's describing how bad most poets are, and then he says, in the only couplet fraught with some unmeaning thing they call a thought, a needless Alexandrine ends the song that, like a wounded snake, drags its slow length along. So what's that? Okay. At a guess, how many syllables in that last line? That, like a wounded snake, drags its slow length along? Good guess. Yes. And if you leave out wounded, you hear it's iambic pentameter, that like a snake drags its slow length along. So Pope is also showing that, but there's a joke at his own expense because his first name is Alexander. So he's saying, God, lines that are written in honor of Alexander, no, I don't want any of that. So that's a typical joke of Pope's. You could say that Tennyson is a very serious Pope. That is, he does the same effects, he has the same sense of poetry, but without turning it into something funny. Occasionally he does, he's often very charming, but that's not his main goal. So, here is the steersman for Odysseus' boat. And he says, don't worry, they're out of the open sea. But courage, he said, and pointed toward the land. This mounting wave will roll us shoreward soon. In the afternoon, they came unto a land in which it seemed always afternoon. All round the coast, the languid air did swoon, breathing like one that hath a weary dream. Full-faced above the valley stood the moon, and like a downward smoke, the slender stream along the cliff to fall and pause and fall did see. So it's almost Alice in Wonderland. They see a rivulet, a waterfall, but it's just falling so slowly. A land of streams, some like a downward smoke, slow dropping veils of thinnest lawn did go, and some through wavering lights and shadows broke, rolling a slumberous sheet of foam below. They saw the gleaming river seaward flow from the inner land. Far off, three mountain tops, three silent pinnacles of aged snow stood sunset flushed and dewed with showery drops of clomb the shadowy pine above the woven copse. The charmed sunset lingered low adown in the red west through mountain clefts. The dale was seen far inland, and the yellow down, bordered with palm, and many a winding vale and meadow set with slender galling gale. A land where all things always seemed the same, and round about the keel with faces pale, dark faces pale against that rosy flame, the mild-eyed melancholy lotus eaters seemed. Branches they bore of that enchanted stem, laden with fruit, with flowering fruit, whereof they gave to each. But whoso did receive of them a taste, to him the gushing of the wave far, far away did seem to mourn and rave on alien shores. And if his fellows spake, his voice was thin as voices from the grave, and deep asleep he seemed, yet all awake, and music in his ears, his beating heart did make. They sat them down upon the yellow sand, between the sun and moon upon the shore, and sweet it was to dream of fatherland, child and wife and slave, but evermore most weary seemed the sea, weary the oar, weary the wandering fields of barren foam. Then someone said, we will return no more, and all at once they sang, our island home is far beyond the wave. We will no longer roam. So just notice how hypnotic that is. And just to point out a couple of other moments, or can someone say what else makes it hypnotic? Any other effect that makes it hypnotic besides what I've already mentioned?
Silence.
So how do you hypnotize someone, do you know? What's the standard cartoon version of hypnotizing someone?
With a little dangly pendant thing, just kind of repeatedly just moving back and forth.
Crucial word, repeatedly,
yeah.
Going back and forth. So what repetitions do you see here? Yeah.
Like the water, the stream, like gushing and waves. You just like keeps repeating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's constant repetition. It's gorgeous. And part of it is that there's a kind of weaving of repetition. So yeah, it's the end of the first stanza. And like a downward smoke, the slender stream along the cliff, the fall and pause and fall, it seemed a land of streams. So there's the word stream picked up from the previous stanza. Like a downward smoke. So the last few lines of the first stanza just get repeated in the first line of the second stanza. Or the end of the second stanza, stood sunset flushed, and dewed with showery drops, upclomb the shadowy pine above the woven copse, the charmed sunset lingered low adown. So you get the sunset at the end of the second stanza, and then again at the beginning of the third stanza. Or look at an effect that you may or may not have noticed. But courage, he said, and pointed toward the land. So I asked you to look at the rhyme scheme there. What's rhyming with land?
Mm-hmm.
Land. So usually we hate that when someone rhymes a word with itself. Usually you notice that in English poetry, and it just doesn't work. But here it really works. Here it's part of that sense of calming repetition. So courage, he said, that sounds active, but that's the end of the activity in the poem. Courage, he said, and pointed toward the land. This mounting wave will roll us shoreward soon. And then soon is already slowing things down. And then in the afternoon, they came onto a land in which it seemed always afternoon. So land rhyming with land will roll us shoreward soon in the afternoon. You're already getting the rhyme. They came onto a land in which it seemed always afternoon. So you get the rhyme word early, and then you get it again after a delay. You're waiting for the rhyme with soon. He gives it to you four syllables later. But then you still wait till you finally get it at the end of the line. So that's an example of what Tennyson does as a poet. If you read the excerpts from Maud, which you did, or I'll say when you read the excerpts from Maud, you might have wondered what that poem's about. It's a narrative poem. It's a poem of jealousy and murder and all sorts of things, but it's also just the narrator gets lost in the experience of his obsession with Maud. So you couldn't tell that from the excerpts, that it's a narrative poem. It's as though lyric is always overcoming narrative in Tennyson, which is a pretty amazing thing. Okay, what I want us to look at least for a little while, is In Memoriam. A passage that couple of stanzas that are not in this anthology are also very famous. So Nature Red, Tooth and Claw, you got to, and that's very famous. Probably even more famous from In Memoriam are the lines, "'Tis better to," anyone know? "'Tis better to have
loved
than
to have loved all."
than never to have loved at all. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than ever to have loved at all. So Tennyson tells himself that early on in the poem. He worked on this for like a decade and a half. He mourned Hallam for almost a period of time, which is like, you know, almost as long as a lifetime, if you're measuring lifetimes by Hallam's. And he says it early on, 'tis better to have loved and lost. He tells himself that. But then finally at the end of the poem, he repeats it. And he says, I said it when I doubted most. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And towards the end of the poem, he convinces himself that that's not entirely wrong. But at the beginning, that's a desperate idea. Okay, he died, that's terrible, but better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And he's not sure that that's true. He's not sure at all that that's true. So that's one of the things that's going on in Memoriam. Let's look at some of it. So, just trying to think. Let's look at 11. That's page 24. So here we get something that might be worth comparing a little bit to the Lotus Eaters. Can someone read it? Those five stanzas, 20 lines. Yeah, go for it, Sam.
Calm is the morn without a sound, calm as the soup of calmer grief, and only through the faded leaf that sheds the pattern to the ground, a calm and deep peace on this live woman cold, and on these dews that drench the fruits, and all the silver gossamers that twinkle into green and gold, calm and still light on your great plain that sweeps with all its autumn bowers and crowded farms. Lessening towers to mingle with the bounding main, calm and deep peace in this wide air, these leaves that redden to the fall, and in my heart, if calm at all, if any calm, but calm despair. Calm on the seas and deep sleep, silver sleep, and waves that sway themselves in rest, and dead calm in the noble breast which heaves out with the heaving deep.
Great. Thank you. So, what happens in section 11? How does it sound at the start? So he's in mourning, and what's he achieved? Yeah. So it starts like, okay, calm as to suit a calmer grief. That is that the acute phase is over. The despair, he gets the news, and he experiences absolute despair. But now this morning that he's sitting down to write, it's a calm morning. And it's not, yay, happy, it's all great. It's calm is the morn without a sound. That is that he is maybe, I don't know, how would you describe that feeling that he seems to be describing here, which is at the start of section 11. Obviously not joy. Yeah, so.
Like some sort of stillness, like in the grief, it's some sort of calm.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I think it's kind of, could have even been cliche back then, but the idea that, like, as you have this internal world, the actual world goes on.
Yeah. Okay, so the actual world is going on, but here it's calm outside and calm, or maybe a way to put this is, under what conditions would you, no, let me reverse that. When you're feeling grief, what do you want the outside world to be like? And what does what you want say about where you are in your grief? So, you know, think of something like King Lear. If you're feeling grief, when would you want it to be stormy outside? At what point in your experience of grief would you want storms, world-destroying storms everywhere? Yeah.
You're angry.
Yeah. So angry is new, right? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah.
It's new. You haven't calmed down yet. You're shaking your fist at the sky, and you want, you know, thunder and lightning would be appropriate. It's rage everywhere, and if the world is raging at you, well, yeah, it is raging at you. That's why the person you loved was destroyed. So that would be appropriate, let's say, for the immediate, acute, outraged experience of grief. So when would you want the world to suit? I mean, there are lots of ways that grief is externalized, or at least the experience of the external world either suits or doesn't suit the grief that you feel. So if you're feeling terrible grief and you're walking through a playground and all the kids are having fun, how do you feel about all the fun they're having? All right, put it differently. You're feeling terrible grief and you walk through a state fair and people are just having a really great time doing the games and having fun. Yeah.
I mean, you're like, how can everyone be having fun when I'm living this way right now?
Yeah. So what you might do is seek some other place which is more appropriate to how you're feeling. And so we can flip that, we can do the converse and say whatever you feel is appropriate to how you're feeling is a good way of describing the grief that you feel. So that if you're Shakespeare and you write King Lear with the storm right in the middle of the play, the reason you're doing it is because that is a good externalization of how Lear is feeling internally. So if you're doing the fiction, you do the, or, you know, if you're making a movie, you do the effects so that they are appropriate to how a character is feeling. So here what he's saying is, it's calm. Calm as the morn without a sound. Calm as to suit a calmer grief. So what you're not getting there is acute despair, but you're also not getting hope. It's not like, oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling everything's going my way. No, that's not the morning that he wants. He doesn't want a beautiful morning or a beautiful day. But this calmness, that maybe is appropriate to how he's feeling. So at first you feel like, okay, that's an achievement. Not a great achievement, but it's something that he can be reconciled with the world maybe, in a way that you're not reconciled if people are partying but you're in despair. But here it's, okay, the world is a place I can be. It's not good, I'm not happy about it, but I don't feel completely isolated from the world. I feel like the world is empty, I'm empty, but there, at least, we're in the same mood. So calm is the morn without a sound, calm is the suit of calmer grief, and only through the faded leaf, the chestnut pattering to the ground, So the chestnuts are falling, the leaves have faded, all of that is appropriate. Calm and deep peace on this high wold and on these dews that drench the firs and all the silvery gossamers that twinkle into green and gold. That sounds maybe a little bit more hopeful, which might be a good thing, that he's seeing some beauty in the world. Calm and still light on yon great plain that sweeps with all its autumn bowers and crowded farms and lessening towers to mingle with abounding main. So now he's seeing a landscape, and it's autumn, and there's calmness, which is also expanding, makes the world more expansive than he felt. Calm and deep peace in this wide air. So deep peace. How good is that? If you just saw that line alone, calm and deep peace in this wide air, would that be an optimistic or a pessimistic?
More optimistic than pessimistic.
Yeah, peace. Peace is a good thing, right? Deep peace. Not just, oh yes, the peace of the grave. Think of the end of Wuthering Heights. A quiet grave. But deep peace. You're skeptical.
Yeah, because the same thing that does envy, like any comic come disappear.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's where it's going. Yeah. But it's how it gets there. So the question is, so at this point, we may be being led down a garden path into thinking, he's recovering. That is, yeah, the acute phase is over, it's terrible, but how do you recover from terrible grief? Well, one stage in that recovery is getting used to it and calming down. You know, think of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you all know that, the six stages of dealing with finding out that you're gonna die. So one stage of recovering from grief, one stage in mourning, is the stage where it's no longer new to you and where you can kind of be used to it. There are lots of narratives, of which In Memoriam is maybe the first, I don't know, I'm just saying that and I'm not certain of it, but I'm not certain it isn't, which describe a really long period of recovery from terrible grief. Does anyone know Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking, the Whitman poem? That's also narrating recovery from grief. So lots of monologues, lots of interior monologues that describe recovery from grief, from absolute denial to bitter acceptance, to the bitterness of the acceptance becoming more peaceful, to a kind of recovery. And it's not clear what kind of recovery you get in memoriam. It's a very odd and strange one, but it could be that that is a way of describing at least what it looks like it's going to do. So deep peace, just those two words by themselves, those are good. That's good, deep peace, right? Does any of you not want deep peace? Hey, you can have some deep peace. No, thank you. I'd rather be miserable every second. So it sounds like recovery, calm and deep peace in this wide air, these leaves that redden to the fall, and in my heart, and then the turn, the surprise. If calm at all, if there's any calm in my heart, unlike in this outside world, if there's any calm in my heart, it is, what kind of calm? Leon?
The desperate or kind of calm?
Yeah, if any calm, a calm despair. So it's not like the despair is gone, which is what calmness seems to suggest. Deep peace and calm despair are antonyms to each other. Calm on the seas of silver sleep and waves that sway themselves in rest. That sounds beautiful, hypnotic, calming down, and dead calm in that noble rest. So what does dead calm mean? Where would you see that generally? Do you think you'd see that phrase? You've seen it, for sure. You'd seen the weather report. And in particular, you'd see it in a maritime weather report. The water is dead calm. Nothing is moving. No waves at all. So that, the waves that sway themselves at rest, okay, not quite dead calm. But now the next line, even calmer than that, than these little waves on this peaceful day on the waters. Dead calm in that noble breast. Whose breast is it? Who's he talking about?
Arthur.
Helen, yeah, Arthur Helen. Which heaves, but with a heaving deep. So, not that calm if he's heaving, but calm within. He's dead. So he's being brought up and down by this metaphorical ocean. Notice how the deep peace of the fourth stanza becomes the heaving deep of this last stanza. And notice the assonance there too. Deep peace, heaving deep. So no, this apparent calmness becomes really grim. It's the calmness of despair and not a calmness which calms despair. So a calm despair, thinking about the dead calm, where the word dead now doesn't mean, yes, a very peaceful day. The windsock is just going straight down to the ground. But no, the calm of the dead. So this is a moment that looks like recovery, but isn't. A moment that looks like, okay, I'm going to find a way to get over Helen's death, and doesn't. Let's look at 54. Another poem of hope, and maybe not. Oh, yet we trust. So that's good, right? Having trust. Yes, this person died, but trust in the Lord. Oh, yet we trust that somehow good will be the final goal of ill. To pangs of nature, sins of will, defects of doubt, and taints of blood. So somehow we think it's all going to work out. The final goal of ill, of pangs of nature, sins of will, defects of doubt, and taints of blood. We trust that nothing walks with aimless feet, that not one life shall be destroyed or cast as rubbish to the void when God hath made the pile complete. So, how many of you have read Hamlet? So do you remember what Hamlet says about the fall of the sparrow?
There's a providence in this?
A special providence to the fall of the sparrow. Every sparrow that dies, this goes back to the New Testament, Jesus says, God knows. God is paying attention to every sparrow that dies. So you don't have to worry. So he's saying, this is what we trust. That nothing walks with aimless feet. That there's nothing in the world, no animal in the world, no creature in the world that is there for no reason. That not one life shall be destroyed or cast as rubbish to the void. That's pretty grim image. He's saying it doesn't happen. But not one life will be cast as rubbish to the void. Think about the depths of his despair, that is a thought in his mind. That lives are cast as rubbish to the void. So we trust that doesn't happen. When God hath made the pile complete. What pile is that? Pile of what?
Life.
Pile of?
Life.
Okay, a pile of life. So God has made the pile of life complete. Okay, so I don't suggest you say to someone that you're trying to get the good graces of, you know, you're just a pile of life. So the word pile, do you feel its strangeness? So where we would usually use it in an insulting context would be in something like pile of shit. He doesn't quite mean pile of shit, but he doesn't mean something that different. Pile of, use a word earlier in the stanza.
Rubbish.
Yeah, pile of rubbish. So once the pile of rubbish is ready to be taken out, we're sure that every bit of it will be reused and recycled. Right? Don't worry, none of this is going to go on the rubbish heap. Every life will matter. Not one life shall be destroyed or cast as rubbish to the void when God has made the pile complete. So we trust that, but look at how the imagery is taking over from the ostensible trust that he's making. Yes, when this dumpster is full of the dead, when it's totally full, it can't add one more sparrow to it, then God is not going to destroy any of it. So it's a really awful image. Put under the rubric of trust, but he's not saying it doesn't happen. What he's saying is we trust that God won't destroy all this. We trust that not a worm is cloven in vain, that not a moth with vain desire is shriveled in a fruitless fire, or but subserves another's gain. So, no, he doesn't trust that. He doesn't see a moth fly into a candle flame and say, yes, I'm sure that God is going to bring that moth to the afterlife. I'm sure that worm that's been cut by the plow is going to be part of heaven. So he's reducing human life to just what happens to insects. He goes on, behold, we know not anything. So we trust, we don't know it. I can but trust that good shall fall at last far off, at last to all. So you can see how he's pushing it. This is not what he believes. What do you think of the word fall, that good shall fall? Doesn't sound so good. But then you get the enjambment. At last, far off, at last to all. He's trying to rescue this idea that the good fall. And every winter change to spring. So all I can do is trust that. So runs my dream. It's a dream. But what am I? An infant crying in the night. An infant crying for the light and with no language but a cry. So that's all he is a cry. Let's go to 55 on the next page. 55 and 56 are really pretty grim. Remember, he's read geology. He has read, he knows that the pile of rubbish can be read in stones, that fossils are everywhere, that what Lyell did was worked out. The ages of rocks by the fossils to be found in the fossil record. Do people know about that? That if you go through a road cut, even if you're on the Mass Pike in western Massachusetts, and you go through a road cut and you look at the granite next to you, you get a history of evolution. High up in the granite are animals that are fossils of animals that might still exist. The lower down you go, the older in time you get to, and so there were all these fossils of non-existent animals that Lyell knew about. That was one way that you could estimate the age of the Earth. That Tennyson knew about, reading Lyell when he was 21 years old. Terrible muse, geology. So, the wish that of the living whole no life may fail beyond the grave, derives it not from what we have, the likest God, within the soul? So, why do we wish that people will live on after they die? Because what does the rhetorical question say the answer to that is? Where does this wish come from? The wish that of the living whole no life may fail beyond the grave, derives it not from what we have, the likest God within the soul. Paraphrasing. Yeah, Julie.
Is the fact that we don't like the idea that someone's life doesn't continue in some way, because isn't that because we see within people some, like, the closest thing to the divine is what we see in other people?
Okay, and what we care about.
Yeah.
In other people, and the fact that we care about them. So the fact that we have this wish, it comes from what is most godlike within us. But if what's godlike is within us, if you're a skeptical Freudian, so by skeptical Freudian I don't mean, yeah, it's all about sex. What's really deep about Freud is how it's all about death. But Freud was an atheist, and he thought that all religious belief was wish fulfillment. And so if you're a skeptical Freudian, if you believe that belief is wish fulfillment, then would Freud disagree with this? Or what would this prove about God? Maybe I asked that question a little bit wrongly. Let's say Freud would say, yes, that wish, because Freud says wish fulfillment is everything for human beings. Everything that we do is designed to fulfill wishes, and all our misapprehensions, all our false beliefs are wish fulfillments. Why do we believe in God, says Freud? Out of wish fulfillment, that we don't have to die, that those we love don't have to die. Why do we believe that our lives will be better than the lives of the other 8 million people on Earth? Wish fulfillment. We are always convincing ourselves that our wishes will be granted, or fantasizing about the granting of those wishes, or even believing in the granting of those wishes. So let's say Freud says yes. So let's say the wish, Freud says, you know, the wish that of the living whole no life may fail beyond the grave, a ridiculous wish, where does it derive from? Doesn't it derive from what we have, the likest God within the soul? So if Freud's answer to that is yes, you might say no, it's no. That would be the easy answer. If it's yes, what would he mean by that, knowing that he doesn't believe in God? Is that too weird a question, or does that question make sense? Yeah.
Is that it's not true that life will not fail beyond the grave, so that it could fail? Like, there isn't, like, this any kind of idea of an afterlife if there isn't for God?
Okay, wait, so, I'm sorry, say it again.
Sorry. That if what he's, or that if there isn't a God, then life can fail beyond the grave, because
uh-huh.
There's no prospect of an afterlife. There's, like, no prospect of
heaven. Okay, good, yeah. So where does the wish come from? Okay, nice, ingenious. Focus on, derives it not from what we have, the likest God within the soul. So where does the wish derive from? It derives from what's closest to God within the soul, right? So what does that say about God?
God's inside us, our soul.
Yeah, but if you don't believe in God, if that's not a good thing, but a skeptical thing. So, Dr. Freud, I really believe in God. Yes, because you believe in...
humanity, God is human.
He wants to be so nice, but he's not.
Wishful.
Because, what is it?
Wishful.
Yeah, it's a, God is an illusion from within the soul. Yeah, there's a soul, we live. So the word soul sounds religious. Where does God come from? It comes from the fact that we have human experiences and we say, there must be a God and I'm going to believe in him and worship him in hopes of salvation and an afterlife. So where does this come from? It's pure wish fulfillment that comes from, and where can you find something that looks like God? Just do MRIs of people's brains and you'll see the part of the brain that thinks there's a God. So, so it sounds good. Oh, human soul contains something, some apprehension of God. But no, maybe God himself is pure wish fulfillment that comes from the soul. But maybe there is God. Maybe we can look at the soul, we see there's belief in God, all cultures have gods. Maybe that's something true. That's what Plato would say. So he goes on. Are God and nature then at strife, that nature lends such evil dreams? So nature makes us despair. God created nature, supposedly, and yet nature makes you not believe in God. So are they then at strife, that nature lends such evil dreams? So careful of the type she seems, so careless of the single life. So, yeah, nature makes sure that, thousands of baby seals are born off the coast of Scotland, but only 1 in 100 will survive. So nature doesn't care about each baby seal, just as long as the species survives. That's what type means here. So careful of the type she seems, so careless of the single life. There'll always be people. Population growth is expanding exponentially. So the little baby died, so what? That's nature's attitude, seems to be. So careful of the type she seems, so careless of the single life, that I consider it everywhere her secret meaning in her deeds, and finding that of 50 seeds she often brings but one to bear. So all this waste. When I think about that, I falter where I firmly trod, and falling with my weight of cares upon the great world's altar stairs that slope through darkness up to God, I stretch lame hands of faith and grope and gather dust and chaff and coal to what I feel is Lord of all, and faintly trust the larger hope. So desperate, why do I believe in God? Out of despair. Next stanza. So careful of the type. What's he quoting there?
Himself.
Yeah, he's quoting himself. Wait, I said nature was careful of the type? Look at geology. So careful of the type, but no. From scarped cliff and quarried stone, she cries, a thousand types are gone, I care for nothing. All shall go. So how does she cry those things from cliff and stone? Because that's what the fossil record teaches us. All these fossils of species of types that no longer exist. So careful of the type, at least the species will last. Nope, look at the fossils. Look at all those dinosaurs. She wasn't careful about them. She wasn't careful about most species that ever existed are gone. So she doesn't care. So what's going to happen to us? Man, and thou makest thine appeal to me, says nature. I bring to life, I bring to death. The spirit does but mean the breath. I know no more. So the word spirit, as you probably know, means breath, as in expiration, when you breathe your last, you expire, or respiration, when you breathe. So yeah, you have spirits, because you breathe. That's all it means. Not a soul. And he, asks Tennyson, shall he, man, her last work, who seemed so fair, such splendid purpose in his eyes, who rolled the song to wintry skies, who built him things of fruitless prayer. So we prayed fruitlessly to God. We sang songs to the sky. Who trusted God was love indeed, and trusted that love was creation's final law, though nature, red in tooth and claw, with rapping, shrieked against his creed. Who loved, who suffered countless ills, who battled for the true, the just, shall man be blown about the desert dust, or sealed within the iron hills? And the answer, at least here, he thinks, is yes, that is what's going to happen. So just go, we have a couple more minutes. Go to page 29, this is 95. And he's remembering the past. And he's alone in the house. And he's reading his journals, his poetry. And then at line 33, so word by word and line by line, the dead man touched me from the past. And all at once it seemed at last the living soul was flashed on mine. And mine, this was wound and whirled above imperial heights of thought, and came on that which is, and caught the deep pulsations of the world. Go to, finally, page 31, stanza 123. There rolls the deep where grew the tree. So there are oceans where there used to be trees growing. There grows the deep where the tree once grew. O earth, what changes hast thou seen? There where the long street roars hath been the stillness of the central sea. So our streets used to be underwater, used to be seas here. The hills are shadows, and they flow from form to form, and nothing stands. They melt like mist. The solid lands like clouds, they shape themselves and go. But in my spirit will I dwell, and dream my dream and hold it true. For though my lips may breathe adieu, I cannot think the thing farewell. So just very briefly to say what happens in In Memoriam is that Tennyson feels a loss which fills him with such despair, astonishing despair, the entire universe. He feels the vastness of the universe and its emptiness. This vast universe, no matter how vast it is, it's empty. And that itself becomes for him a sign of how important Hallam was to him. His own obsession becomes a tribute to the person that he's lost. And the worse the loss, the greater the tribute that the very badness of that loss means. And what can he do with that tribute? He can only have these experiences of loss and of the eloquent expression of despair, which is what In Memoriam is about. Okay, keep reading. There's one or two things more to say about Tennyson, which we will on Monday, but just keep up with reading on the syllabus. I'll just quickly say that one of the last poems you read was to Edward Fitzgerald. And Edward Fitzgerald is something we're going to read later. He is very famous for his poem, which is a free translation of Omar Khayyam, called The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And he's great. A loaf of bread, a jug of wine, a vow, or the moving finger writes and having writ moves on. So you'll recognize a whole lot of Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. It was one of the most popular poems, maybe the most popular poem of the 19th century. Okay, Tennyson is hard, things will be easier, but we'll do a little bit more, a few more minutes on Tennyson on Monday. Have a good weekend. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.